There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it. There you go. With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 1077, January 3rd, 2025. Nasser.
Thank you, sir. All is quiet on New Year's Day. Bono has lost his edge for 2025. In the goodie bag, we have British riders on prancing horse. We shall explain gladly with green sleeves. Now back to His Majesty of podcasting and humility.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Happy New Year to the entire F1 Weekly familia. Dakar Rally has begun, and Toyota is on top for the prologue. Aston Martin thanks Fernando for keeping his cool in 2024. And LCH arrives at Ferrari with Roscoe for his first cooking lesson. How to master the marinara sauce. And this week's Motorsports Mondial will be historical mondial. We're talking a plethora of facts, history, data. Get your pen and paper out because you're going to love every minute of this. And don't forget, yes, we do need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab because we all know server space will be more expensive in 2025. Nasser, thanks for the intro. Very royal of you. What a fantastic Dakar rally we have. Then Monte Carlo is going to be coming up. Jesus, my God, we've got so much on the plate. Nas, welcome to the studio. How you doing?
Well, it's time to say Happy New Year to all the members of F1 Weekly Familia. Coast to coast, LA to MA, and around the world. We wish everybody good health, happiness, and that eternal pipe dream of mankind, peace. Most importantly, I cannot stress the importance of having a competitive and combative season of Formula Uno. We are now less than 90 days from cars and tires squealing in Albert Park on March 16th. What is the host looking forward to in Dakar and Formula One preseason testing?
Well, there's always a lot to look forward to in Dakar, but of course this season with Carlos Sainz Jr. losing his position at Ferrari, I'm sure he's going to be with his papa. His papa is driving for Ford, the Raptor pickup truck. Sort of a pickup truck, I guess. But it's going to be very exciting. I think they're going to be very competitive. Of course, Toyota is going to be up there. Unfortunately, I wish I could say that Renault and Peugeot and Citroën are up there. But they'll be in the historical rally that gets very little press coverage. But it is awesome as usual. So, yeah. Fun. The photographs, the activity, the camaraderie amongst the drivers. Dakar is really a big familia, just like over here at the Palatial Studios, Nasser.
Now we move on to numbers game. Last week we had some interesting information from social media. This week we have more of the same from the Facebook page of Formula One. They have a listing of drivers who scored the most points but did not win a championship. And as we all know, there have been some great drivers, Stirling Moss, Ronnie Peterson, who unfortunately did not win the championship. They say nice guys finish last. In this case, nice guy is finishing first. Valtteri Bottas has scored the most points, 1,797, without becoming world champion. Misery loves company, so Sergio Perez is second on 1,638 points. Third man on the podium with 1,430 points is Charles Leclerc. And if he thought that was a problem, well, all he has to do in Albert Park, look on the name on the other side of the garage. That's where the real problems will start. Most likely for both of them. Time will tell, and we shall see. Mr. Rogers, in the time you have been following Formula One, what names come to mind who should have been world champions?
Well, just like yourself, I mean, Peterson, obviously Stirling Moss, one of the great greats of Formula One, a legend for sure, and no world championship. So world championships are hard to get. People forget the planets have to really line up perfectly, but some individuals have been able to accomplish this, which is absolutely awesome. But of course, I mean, I thought Daniel Ricciardo would be a world champion. I thought Nico Hülkenberg, when I saw him driving in the rain, I thought he'd be world champion. It's amazing how many people you start thinking as soon as you see them perform on the track against big competition, yet the elusive world championship can be quite brutal. So Norris, I'm sure, is taking notes. He's got his notepad out. And you're right, Mr. Nice Guy, you need to get over being nice all the time. And that's just the way it is. It's a brutal sport. Yeah, if just one thing is out of place, like the engine, you know, GP2 engine, things can go very, very wrong, Nasser.
Now if we move on to some good news. Oh dear, OBE for MB. Martin Brundle, man who raced against Ayrton Senna and was teammate to Michael Schumacher, and most importantly, has been in the palatial studios of F1 Weekly more than once, has received an OBE, Order of British Empire, for his services to motor racing and broadcasting. Congratulations to Mr. Brundle, or is it now Sir Brundle? We need to know. Question for you, sir. Are you happy for MB, or are you among the Brundle haters, accusing him of being purveyor of British bias? What say you?
Well, when I first saw the news, I thought he got an honorary doctorate, like an OBGYN, but apparently I was wrong. But let's face it, folks, there's nothing wrong with being biased, because that's human nature. I mean, it's just the way it is. The funny thing is, for me, is to not admit your bias when it's just right here in black and white and a little gray in the middle. So I don't mind bias. The British press have been biased, but the Dutch press is biased. The French press is biased. That is la nature of the people, which is fine. I mean, I don't have a problem with it. I just have a problem with it when they go, huh? What, me? I's not biased. So, I mean, let's all just hug, kiss, and love each other. But congratulations to Brundle. He was a great driver. He had a great career, great teammates as usual. You know the kind. And yes, congratulations. Yeah, Dr. Brundle, I presume.
Now we come to the postman rings twice. The Western Union man rings only once. They say reaching the top is hard, which is very true. Staying there is even harder. Nick DeVries proved that point not too long ago, and he's not the only one. In 2025, there are many drivers whose contract will expire at the end of the season. Some are Cool Hand Luke with experience. Others are working on the chain gang, as they say in the song Buffalo Soldier, fighting on arrival, fighting for survival. When the paymaster is Flavio Briatore or Dr. Marco, they may tolerate failure to communicate, but what they will not tolerate is failure to perform. Here's looking at you kids, Jack and Liam. If they don't perform, they will be sent sailing away to Key Largo, just like Bogey and Bacall. Liam Lawson has what DC calls the least desirable seat in Formula One. On the other hand, JV calls the Kiwi arrogant. Dr. Marco has the best advice for the new driver. Don't try to beat Max, get as close as you can. I think this is a very good idea. Trying to beat Max took his other teammates off the track and off the team very quickly. I am hoping Lawson will dig in deep, be smart and sensible, and not be half a second slower at the end of Q3 in Albert Park. Half a second slower, of course, relative to his teammate. If he can work to improve his time step by step, and most importantly, bring the car home within two or three places of where Max finishes, I think he will survive at Red Bull. If Liam can do at Red Bull what Daniel Ricciardo did to Sebastian Vettel, I say more power to him. But if anybody thinks that Liam can win more races than Max in their first season together as teammate, I suggest they drink their Folgers to the last drop and wake up. And please stay away from Kool-Aid at this part of the season. If there is a seat on the chopping block this season, it is at Alpine and Jack Doohan. Flavio Briatore has an L plan, but his plan means business and is executed very thoroughly. He may have seen the future in Colapinto, and if Jack struggles, he will put him in the box and ship it. The Western Union man rings once with the message we all have seen at least once in our lifetime. Your services are no longer required. The most interesting seat that may be available at the end of the season is at Mercedes. Both drivers, George Russell and Kimi Antonelli, will have to renew or look for a new team at the end of the season. This is where the high drama of the season will be played. In 2026, Red Bull powertrain and Ford will have their own engine for the first time. This is big decision time for Max and his management team, which would be Mr. Raymond Vermeulen and Pepito Yost, the boss. I think if Max wants to avoid his own W13 moment, he should move to Mercedes, because with all the resources they have, I just cannot see that team staying down way too long. There are no vacancies at Ferrari and McLaren, but in the world of Formula One, vacancy can be created for a talent like Max. Mercedes has spent a lot of time and money on Kimi Antonelli, so I think we will see him at Mercedes for more than one season, unless he totally flops, in which case insurance or at least temporary coverage is provided by Bottas, who is now back with Toto as a reserve driver. Now we come to another man with contract expiring at the end of the season, Yuki Tsunoda. He and Honda are like the song Moon River. Wherever you're going, I'm going your way. Now that Honda engine is winning, they are no longer two drifters off to see the world.
Two drifters off to see the world. There's such a lot of world to see.
Thank you, Mr. Johnny Mercer and Mr. Mancini. Honda at Aston Martin means highly likely that Yuki will be there, especially if Machismo retires. The only thing that will prevent Yuki at Aston Martin is if Mr. Stroll gives a blank check to Max. You never know. Finally, we have Isaac Hadjar, behaving like Isaac Hayes. Mr. Horner is very excited that his times were faster than Yuki in the postseason testing, which of course took place in Abu Dhabi after the Grand Prix. The kid has the talent and the speed with the attitude of Montoya. Not the best of combination in your rookie season, especially under the watchful eye of Dr. Marco. Now let's hear from the host who will survive and who will thrive among the rookies.
Oh, it's going to be a tough season, but I think Hadjar really does show a lot of speed. So it's going to be very, very exciting. Of course, everybody's going to be watching Liam Lawson, how he handles competing with Max, because that takes really a really good mindset. You have to be strong and heavy-willed. I think that's going to be a big test for him and his parents. And Antonelli, Kimi, Toto has already said, oh, we're going to go into this slowly, let him make mistakes. And I think that's a nice cautious approach. That way you don't have egg on your face in the middle of the season. But all these rookies are going to struggle a little bit. I feel bad for Doohan because he's been waiting for a long time, like Drugovich at Aston Martin, waiting, but yet still a bridesmaid. It's sort of tough on some of these younger drivers, but hey, he'll get a little experience under his belt, and hopefully IndyCar will have a position. You never know, because I have a funny feeling that Flavio has already made up his mind on Colapinto, because we're not going to see Colapinto drive at the beginning of the season. So I think Flavio has made a decision here. He just wants to see how Doohan does. But if Doohan does what I think Doohan can do, then Colapinto will not be necessary. But no, we have a lot of things to pay attention to. And of course, we're still not talking about LCH and Roscoe over at Maranello. Gracias.
Now we come to historical Mondial. Once upon a time, happiness for mankind used to start in January. So today we shall look at seasons in the sun when Formula One season started with the start of the calendar year. The inaugural F1 season started in May 1950. The first time January hosted the opening round was 1953. The season saw Alberto Ascari become sport's first double world champion with Ferrari. His papito Antonio was also a famous and successful racing driver. He was killed while leading the French Grand Prix at Moleri in an Alfa Romeo, and I believe it was entered by a Scuderia Ferrari. Amazingly, since 1953, the land of Novellari, Ferrari, Monza and Imola has not produced a Formula One world champion. So, a lot is riding on Kimi Antonelli's shoulders. Imagine Kimi winning at Monza, if only he was in a Ferrari. January hosted the opening round for the next five seasons. And from 1954 to 57, Fangio was the world champion. The 1954 season featured nine races, including the Indy 500. Opening round was in Argentina and won by local hombre Fangio in a Maserati. Later in the season, he switched to Mercedes and took his second championship at the end of the season. The 1955 season started in Buenos Aires, also known as Buenos Aires, on January 16. Fangio was the winner in a Mercedes. 1956, once again Buenos Aires and once again Fangio the winner, this time after taking over the car of his Ferrari teammate Luigi Musso. Back in those days, you could do that. In 1957, Stirling Moss was the pole sitter and set the fastest lap in the season opener in Buenos Aires. Winner was yet again, more of the same, Fangio. This time back with Maserati to claim his fifth and final championship. The 1958 season went from Argentina in the beginning to Casablanca in the end, Apart from the Indy 500, there were 10 Grand Prix races. 9 of them were won by British drivers. The only non-British winner was your homeboy, fellow Français, Maurice Trintignant at Monaco. Moss won both the opening and final rounds, but Hawthorn beat him to the championship by a single point. One is the loneliest number, but can be
rewarding, very, very, very rewarding.
The next time Formula One season started in January was 1965. The opening round took place on New Year's Day at East London in South Africa. Jim Clark was the winner. He also won the 1965 Indy 500 and the World Championship. Two drivers took their first Grand Prix wins during the season. Jackie Stewart at Monza in a BRM and Richie Ginther in Mexico City for Honda, which was also the first Grand Prix win for the Japanese company. Down the road, Honda made some championship-winning engines for Senna and Max. But they missed the beat for somebody else. Who could that be?
CP2, engine. CP2.
Ah! In 1967, the season started on January 2 at Kyalami in South Africa. Pedro Rodriguez in a Cooper Maserati was the surprise winner. The organizers had not counted on such a surprise and did not have a recording of the Mexican national anthem. So they played Mexican Hat Dance, which I think is a much better choice than playing La Cucaracha. The season saw Dan Gurney winning the Belgian Grand Prix in his own maiden Santa Ana, California Eagle. Kiwi Denny Holm was the world champion in 67. As in those days, death was part of Grand Prix season. In 1967, it happened in Monte Carlo, the fiery crash of Ferrari driver Lorenzo Bandini. The 1968 season started on New Year's Day in South Africa at Kyalami. This was final Formula One race and victory for Jim Clark. It was his 25th win and made him at that time the most successful driver in Formula One, surpassing Fangio's record of 24 wins. Three drivers scored their maiden wins. Bruce McLaren at Spa in his own car, just like Dan Gurney a season early. Jackie Ickx at Rouen in the French Grand Prix, in which local Honda driver Joe Schlesser was killed. And Swiss Joe Siffert at Brands Hatch, the same track where he would be killed 3 years later in a fiery crash. Just like Joe Schlesser, sad but true. On a personal note, Brands Hatch is the first Formula One track I visited in September 1982, a few weeks before the Italian Grand Prix of that year. The Argentine Grand Prix on January 23rd started the 1972 season. Local talent making his Formula One championship debut was Carlos Reutemann. He put his Brabham on pole position. Jackie Stewart won the race and Emerson Fittipaldi won the championship with Lotus. He was the first Brazilian world champion and at 25 years old, the youngest champion at that time. Fittipaldi started the defense of his title by winning the season opener in 1973 on January 28, also in Buenos Aires, and he considers this as his best win as he chased down Francois Sever to take the victory. At the end of the season, Jackie Stewart took his third and final championship before retiring. He would not start his 100th Grand Prix following the death of his teammate Francois Sever in qualifying for season finale at Watkins Glen. Earlier in the year, at the Dutch Grand Prix, young English driver Roger Williamson was killed when his Tom Beechcroft car flipped over and caught fire. And Tom Beechcroft, who has also passed away, used to own the Donington Circuit, and they had a fabulous collection there, which unfortunately is no longer there. The 1974 season, Denny Holm takes his final victory in round one in Argentina on January 13. Two drivers enjoyed their first wins, Carlos Reutemann in South Africa and Jody Scheckter in Sweden. Fittipaldi was the world champion for the second time. He was McLaren's first world champion. For the second year in a row, there was fatality in the final race at Watkins Glen. This time, young Austrian Helmut Koenig was killed after crashing his Surtees into the Amco barriers, and unfortunately, he was decapitated. The 1975 season saw first Ferrari world champion in Niki Lauda since John Surtees in 1964. It all started on January 12th in Buenos Aires. Jean-Pierre Jarier took pole position in his Shadow, UOP Shadow as it was called. James Hunt set the fastest lap in his Hesketh, and MO won the race in his McLaren. Mark Donohue lost his life after a high-speed tire blowout on his Penske car during Sunday's warm-up session at the Österreichring for the Austrian Grand Prix. In 1976, Sao Paulo was the scene of the season opener on January 25th. Lauda won the race and Hunt the championship. And I remember very well Mr. Simon Taylor, the BBC reporter at that time, who went on to become editor of Motorsport magazine. His report started by saying the 1976 season started the way 1975 season ended, meaning victory for Niki Lauda and Ferrari. Lauda had won the 75 Formula One race at Watkins Glen. And during the season of 1976, John Watson gave Roger Penske his only F1 triumph in Austria. On January 9, 1977, it was back to Buenos Aires for round one. Dramatic debut win for Dr. Harvey Postlewhite design car for Canadian oil man Walter Wolff. Schechter was the driver, and Lauda reclaimed his title before giving Johnny Paycheck CD to Enzo.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not.
...1978 was year of the cat called Colin Chapman. His Lotus 79 was a beauty in simplicity, lightness and ground effect, and took Mario Andretti to championship success. The man from Nazareth, PA won the season opener in Argentina on January 15. Two French-speaking drivers took their maiden wins during the season. Patrick Depailler in Monaco for Uncle Ken and Gilles Villeneuve for Enzo in Montreal. On a sad note, Mario's teammate Ronnie Peterson lost his life after a crash at the start at Monza. In October 1978, another Swedish driver, Gunnar Nilsson, winner of the 1977 Belgian Grand Prix, lost his life after a battle with cancer. The first two races of the 1979 season were in South America. Round 1 was in Buenos Aires on January 21, and Round 2 was in Sao Paulo. Both were won by Jacques Lafitte and Eligier Ford. Gilles Villeneuve won the next two races in South Africa and Long Beach in SoCal. When the season was over, Jody Scheckter was world champion for Ferrari. The 1980 season started in Argentina on January 13. Alan Jones was the winner. He would take four other wins to become the first Aussie world champion since Jack Brabham in 1966, which was his third and final championship. The season also saw first Grand Prix win for Didier Pironi in the Belgian Grand Prix at Zolder. And the name Zolder is coming up again soon. The 1982 season started on January 23rd in South Africa. Alain Prost was the winner. What a season of triumphs and tragedies this was. Five drivers won their first Grand Prix. Riccardo Patrese in Monaco, Patrick Tambay in Germany, Elio De Angelis in Austria. The final lap of this race is highly recommended on YouTube as he and Keke Rosberg crossed the line just inches away from each other. And Keke Rosberg himself took his first win in the Swiss Grand Prix, which took place in 1982 outside Switzerland in France at Dijon-Prenois. This would be his only victory of the season, but helped him to become world champion. And of course, finally, the first Grand Prix in Las Vegas in the parking lot of Caesars Palace was won by Michele Alboreto in a Tyrrell. On a sad note, two drivers lost their lives. Villeneuve at Zolder in Belgium and Italian Riccardo Paletti in Montreal. Pironi was lucky to escape death in his horrifying crash at Hockenheim when he plowed into the Renault of Alain Prost and went airborne. Sir, would you have any comments or observation on what we just discussed?
Wow, Nasser. A plethora of information. A lot of deaths. It was a brutal time in Formula One, but a lot of competition. Great racing. And no, that was the beginning. And the beginning sometimes is ugly and tough, but it was still a lot of intense driving. Loved every minute of it.
And with that, Mr. Rogers, I think it's time for some, maybe this time, Snapple iced tea. And we shall come back with Motorsports Mondial.
Thank you, Nasser. So on that note, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back after these brief messages.
Hello, I'm Nikia Johnson, and I'm going to be listening to F1 Weekly.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
And this week's Motorsports Mondial, we have a special presentation. This is a feature we are calling Hawthorne to Hamilton, British Riders on Prancing Horse. Now, Lewis Hamilton will be testing a red car very soon. So we're going to look at all the British drivers who race for Enzo. And as we all know, Commendatore Ferrari did not have much fascination with Garagistas, but he had high regard for drivers from the land where passion for motor racing is as deep and intense as in his own country. Britain has produced 10 World Championship winning drivers, while joint second place nation Brazil and Finland have 3 each. And the Finnish situation is very impressive given the size of the population, which I believe is less than 6 million. Okay, sir. First name on the list is Mr. Mike Hawthorne. He had 45 Grand Prix starts and 35 of those came with Ferrari. He was the first British Grand Prix winner and also the first British world champion. He rode to success driving a Ferrari. His first race win came in the 1953 French Grand Prix at Reims after an epic race-long battle with Juan Manuel Fangio, the pair changing leads several times in the closing laps of the race in the French Champagne region. Apparently, news reports of that era state that this was the greatest race of the century. Fangio's compadre and Maserati teammate Jose Froline Gonzalez was third. During the season, Hawthorne also won the Spa 24-hour race with the 1950 Formula One world champion Signor Nino Farina. Hawthorne's second Ferrari win came in the 1954 Spanish Grand Prix at Pedralbes. His third and final Grand Prix victory came in his championship-winning season, 1958 at Reims. The battle to be the first British world champion was won by Hawthorne by a single point over Stirling Moss at the Ain Diab Street Circuit near Casablanca in October. To this day, apart from Keke Rosberg in 1982, Hawthorn remains the only driver to have clinched the World Championship with a solitary win throughout the season. Sadly, Hawthorn did not live long enough to enjoy his championship glory. In January 1959, he was killed in a road accident in his Jaguar on the Guildford Bypass in Surrey. And sir, before I forget, there are a few names here that I was fortunate, blessed, and lucky enough to go to these gentlemen's home and office and interview them. And all of this was made possible by the European Support Vehicle number 1 of Mr. Peter Brazier. So I would like to thank him very much again for these wonderful memories we have created for the F1 Weekly Familia. The next driver is Peter Collins. He took part in 32 Grand Prix races, 20 of them with Ferrari. Collins was born in Kidderminster, Worcestershire. His claim to fame before joining Ferrari in 1956 was partnering Stirling Moss to victory in the 1955 Targa Florio with Mercedes. In his first season at Maranello, Collins captured his first championship victory at Spa-Francorchamps. That's the place to get your first win. Second victory would follow at Reims. He was third in the championship. In the Mille Miglia, he placed second. In the 1957 Formula One Championship, his best finish was third step of the podium at Rouen and the Nürburgring. And then he won two non-championship Grand Prix races at Syracuse, which would be in Sicily, and our favorite place in Italy, Napoli.
In Napoli, beside the sea, it happened on a night like this.
AKA Naples. In 1958, he scored a popular victory in front of his home crowd at Silverstone in July. In the German Grand Prix on August 3rd, Collins was in pursuit of race leader Tony Brooks in a van wall when he crashed to his death on lap 10 of 15. The next British driver at Ferrari, gentleman by the name of Cliff Ellison. He took part in 16 Grand Prix races, 6 of them with Ferrari. Ellison's career lasted 16 Formula One races, 6 of them in the red car. He made his championship debut with Team Lotus in their first Formula One Grand Prix at Monaco in 1958. He was 6th. The following year at the same circuit by the Mediterranean, he made his Ferrari debut. His final race in the Scarlet Car came in the 1960 season opener in Buenos Aires, where he scored his only podium in second behind the race winner Bruce McLaren. A serious crash in practice for the 1960 Monaco Grand Prix put Ellison in a coma for 16 days and sidelined him for the rest of the season. In life after racing, he returned to his family's garage business and passed away on April 7, 2005, at the age of 73. Now we come to Tony Brooks, the racing dentist, and he was one of the gentlemen, Mr. Brazier and I, went to his house and we were served tea by his Italian wife, so great memories. Tony Brooks took part in 38 Grand Prix races, 7 with Ferrari, and this was a real great talent. Brooks was a 4-time Grand Prix winner when he joined Ferrari for the 1959 season. His first drive in a red car was in the season opener in Monte Carlo. He qualified 4th and finished 2nd behind Jack Brabham, the Aussie mate taking his maiden win in a rear-engine green coupe. Brooks took his first Ferrari win from pole position in his third start for the Maranello-based team in the French Grand Prix at Reims. His 6th and final Formula One victory came in the only German Grand Prix ever held at the fast AWO circuit in Berlin. It was a red sweep of the podium. Behind Brooks were his two Ferrari teammates from California, Dan Gurney in 2nd and Phil Hill 3rd. Brooks finished his first and only season with Scuderia Ferrari as vice champion behind Brabham. After leaving, Ferrari Brooks raced for Cooper, Van Wall, and PRM in his final season in 1961. He went out on a high, reaching the third step of the podium in his final Formula One race at Watkins Glen. This was the first race at the upstate New York circuit, where Scottish driver Innes Ireland gave Colin Chapman's Lotus team the first taste of success in Formula One. The affable racing dentist passed away on May 3, 2022, at the age of 90. Now we come to John Surtees, another gentleman. Mr. Breezy and I went to his office in Edenbridge and had a very nice chat. Our 20-minute request for an interview lasted almost 45, 50 minutes, so great times. John, 111 Grand Prix starts with Ferrari 30. Surtees won championships on both two and four wheels with Italian machinery. His transition from racing on two wheels to four wheels was smooth and swift. He made his Formula One championship debut in the 1960 Monaco Grand Prix with Lotus. He was second in his second race, the British Grand Prix, and took pole position in his third race in Portugal. Surtees joined Ferrari in 1963, and after two podium finishes, third at Zandvoort and second at Silverstone, he took his first victory in his sixth start for Enzo at the daunting Nürburgring. This was his only victory of the season, and he was classified fourth in the championship. In 1964, he made history by becoming, and to this day remaining, the only world champion on two and four wheels. Victory in Germany and Italy, plus four additional podium finishes, earned him the title. The 1965 season was winless for Scuderia and Surtees, and he was fifth in the championship. Surtees started his own Formula One team in 1970 and famously ran the Durex Safe Formula sponsorship in 1976. One of his drivers was fellow motorcycle legend Mike the Bike Hailwood, who gave the team their best result in Formula One with his second place finish at Monza in 1972. It was an ironic tragedy that Surtees, who raced on two and four wheels in an extremely dangerous era of motorsports, would suffer from the death of his 18-year-old son Henry in a Formula 2 accident at Brands Hatch in 2009, and Surtees himself passed away on March 10, 2017 at the age of 83. And you know, many moons ago, maybe 2006 or 2007, I was at the Autosport show and I met John and also had a very brief chat with his son. He was very young, I think, I don't know, 14, 15 at that time. And I remember very well how polite he was. So what a sad day it was when he lost his life at Brands Hatch. Now we come to a gentleman who played a big role at Ferrari, both inside the car and outside the car, and also for the Fiat group. Mike Parks. He started in six Grand Prix races and all of them were with Ferrari. Parkesi, as the Italian used to call him, was a Ferrari racer and engineer who took part in six Formula One events for the Scuderia between 1966 and 67. His dramatic debut came in the 1966 French Grand Prix at Reims, where he qualified third and finished second to Brabham. Parks' only other podium finish came at Monza, where he started from pole position and finished second to teammate Ludovico Scarfiotti, and that was the 66 race, the last time an Italian Grand Prix was won by an Italian driver. After his racing days were over, Parks worked on the development of the Lancia Stratos Rally car, and he was killed in a road accident near Turin in 1977. He was only 45 years old. Now we come to Jonathan Williams. Gentleman made one start, and of course that was with Ferrari. Williams was born in Cairo, Egypt. He started racing when he moved to England. In 1966, he raced successfully in the Italian Formula 3 and was hired by Ferrari for Formula 2 and sports car racing. He raced at Sebring 12 Hour and competed in a couple of Can-Am races here in the U.S. His only Grand Prix appearance came in 1967, Mexico City, as teammate to the luckless Kiwi Chris Amon. An F1 testing crash at Modena Autodromo marked the end of Williams' association with Ferrari. The footage from his Porsche 908 was extensively used in Steve McQueen's movie Le Mans. After his racing days were behind him, Williams took to the skies and became a professional pilot. He then retired and moved to Spain, where he passed away on August 31, 2014. Now we come to Derek Bell. Grand Prix starts 9, two of them with Ferrari. Bell's racing career is ringing with success at Le Mans and in sports car racing. 5 wins in the French Classic, 3 at Daytona 24 Hour, and 2 sports car world championship. So obviously very impressive. Towards the end of the 1968 season, he was entered by Scuderia Ferrari in the Italian and US Grand Prix races, and both resulted in mechanical retirements. His only championship point came from his 6th place finish in the 1970 US Grand Prix, but that was with Surtees team. And now we come to All Rise, Nigel Mansell, Grand Prix start 187, with Ferrari 31. Murray Walker's R. Nige was Tifosi's Il Leone. The gutsy driver from Birmingham was an electrical engineer and had high voltage flowing through him on and off the track, which was evident both on both sides of the pond. Enzo must have been immensely proud of Mansell's incredible balls-to-the-wall move on Gerhard Berger at the fast Peraltada corner in the closing laps of the 1990 Mexican Grand Prix. This is my all-time favorite pass. Mansell took pride in being the last driver signed to drive for Scuderia by Commendatore himself. He repaid his faith by winning on debut with the new John Bernard-designed semi-automatic gearbox Ferrari 640 in the 1989 Rio de Janeiro season opener. His only other victory was at the Hungaroring, where he outfoxed his arch-rival Senna on lap 58 of 77. Mansell was fourth in the 1989 World Championship. His second and final year at Ferrari saw him finished in fifth in the championship, and only victory of the season came in the Portuguese Grand Prix. For the 1991 season, Mansell went back to Williams and, thanks to active suspension FW14B, easily won his long-awaited and, I must say, much-deserved championship in 1992. The following year, he moved to the colonies and won the IndyCar Championship, enjoying at one time the honor of being champion on both sides of the pond. Now we come to Eddie Irvine. Grand Prix starts 145 with Ferrari 65. The flashy driver and his equally flashy manager, Eddie Jordan, went to Geneva for a business meeting. While the driver was feeding ducks at a pond, Jordan sold his contract to Scuderia Ferrari. Irvine out-qualified his then double world champion teammate, a chap by the name of Michael Schumacher, in their first qualifying session together in Elwood Park in 1996. After an impressive debut podium in third, his next podium appearance would not be till the third round of the 1997 season in Argentina. Irvine finished the 1996 season 10th in the championship with 11 points. So that's 10 in the championship, 11 points. And look what the driver he outqualified in the first race did. Schumacher was third in the standings with 59 points. In 1997, Irvine was seventh in the championship with 24 points, while his teammate fought for the championship against Jacques Villeneuve and was disqualified for his stunt in the season finale at Jerez de la Frontera after scoring 78 points. And if Dr. Miguel is listening, I would like to give him a shout out because he was there with me when we went to Jerez in a pre-season testing session. And at the airport, we had the wonderful opportunity of having a brief chat with Charlie Whiting. So good time wherever we are, whenever and wherever we are with F1 Weekly Familia members. Obrigado, senor. The 1998 season was again winless for Irvine, and he was fourth in the championship. His first victory came in the 1999 season opener in Australia. Back-to-back wins in Austria and Germany helped to take the fight to McLaren's Mika Hakkinen for the championship. Schumacher, out of action after breaking his legs at Silverstone, was back in action at Sepang for the Malaysian Grand Prix. And this is where he really showed the difference between a good driver and somebody from a different level. Schumi not only took pole position upon his return to racing, but surrendered the race lead to Irvine not once but twice. The Ulsterman would go on to win the race but lost the championship battle to the Finnish driver. He would never win again in Formula One. Irvine has gone on to enjoy immense financial success as a property developer in Miami. Now we come to whippersnapper Oliver Bearman, Ollie Bearman. Grand Prix start so far 3 with Ferrari 1. This young bright star of British Motorsports is a member of the Ferrari Driving Academy. In the 2024 Saudi Arabian Grand Prix at the fastest street circuit on the schedule, Jeddah Corniche, he was called upon to replace a sick Carlos Sainz at the last minute. Bearman beat the odds, and I was very surprised he did not go into the wall all season long. He qualified 11th and brought the car home in the points in 7th place. A strong season in 2025 with Ferrari-powered Haas F1 is expected. It is only a matter of time before we see him galloping to race wins riding a prancing horse. And now we come to the royal jockey that started this segment. Grand Prix starts 356 with Ferrari at this time as we speak 0, but the show commences on March 16, 2025. Here comes Sir Hamilton to Scuderia Ferrari in January 2025. He will test a red car at Fiorano soon and stay at Commendatore's Casa at the track, a luxury previously accorded only to the high-flying Red Baron. Once the racing season starts, Hamilton will not find a Bottas or a Barrichello on the other side of the garage. Highly talented and rated Charles Leclerc has his own agenda and score to settle, and who can blame him? The man from Monaco is one of the very few on the grid today who can take the fight to Max in a competitive machinery. Hammer time will be clocking the fourth decade on January 7th. The most successful driver in the history of Formula One racing is still looking for that next magic carpet ride after he was very cruelly robbed off of a record-breaking 8th World Championship on that Arabian night in December 2021. The resurgence of Constructors' Championship-winning team is a real threat and headache for the animal house, Red Bull and Prancing Horse. Time will tell how the departure of Adrian Newey from Red Bull and the arrival of Hamilton at Ferrari will shape the fortune of the respective teams. One thing for sure, fans are in for an exciting start to the wonder of Formula One motor racing in Land Down Under on March 16. On a sad note, a NASCAR star, Fred Lorenzen, died at the age of 89 last week, so our condolences to his family. And the Dakar Rally will be starting in a few days, and we have quite a few names there. Carlos Sainz Sr. is there in a Ford Raptor. Your favorite, Sebastian Loeb, is there. So we will see how this thing will work out. And we also have this Formula Regional Oceania Championship that will start next on January 12th, and this is the series which was previously known as Toyota Racing Series, and this is where Liam Lawson really made his name by beating Marcus Armstrong, and it was his good luck. Apparently Dr. Marco was there and was very impressed by his performance. The series official name now is Castrol Toyota Formula Regional Oceania Championship, certified by FIA. Among the drivers, there are two drivers who really should win this championship. If not, we have a problem. One is Arvid Lindblad, a Red Bull Junior, who this year will take part in Formula 2 and did a very good job in Formula 3 last year. Interesting character. He races under the English license, flag, whatever. His father is from Sweden, hence the name Arvid and Lindblad, and what you call Mamito is from India or of Indian origin. And we interviewed this kid, I think, last year. Very nice kid, and we wish him all the best. And the other kid, if this kid, Nikita Johnson, who lives about 20 minutes from where I am in Tampa, Florida, if he can win this championship by beating Arvid Lindblad, that will really stamp his authority. He's very young. I think he just turned 16 a few months ago. And this year he will be racing in GB3 in England. And this kid is very, very talented, real deal. And I think, and he's managed by same people, Infinity Management, who manage George Russell. So he's in good hands. Okay, sir, in some driver news, Beto is back. Brendo Bedower, Bambino of Lucca, who definitely lived on the second floor in Maranello. His son is now part of the McLaren Driver Development Program. So we wish all these people all the best. The Monte Carlo Rally is also starting this year. And I would like to thank Mr. Clark Rogers of F1 Weekly, the charming host, for putting in a request for my media credentials for the Daytona 24-hour race. Whether we get it or not, Moi will be there and hopefully we'll salvage some interviews. But it's a great track, great event. I really enjoy going there. And that should do it for now. And I would like to thank all the listeners for their support. Once again, Happy New Year. And if Mr. Roger, you wish to add something, please do so. Otherwise, we say ta-ta, goodbye.
Outstanding, Nasser. I'm telling you, I learn something every day when I listen to F1 Weekly podcast. So keep up the good work, Nas. Outstanding. Once again, Happy New Year to everybody. Shout out to Toby Dawes, who really is in the background but keeps everything flowing smoothly and on time, just like El Duce. So yes, we have a great season coming up. We have 6 young whippersnappers, Lewis at Ferrari, and we have a possible Fernando with a competitive car, which really adds to our palette of colors. So thank you, Nas. Good night. All enjoy.
River, wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style someday. Old dream maker, you heartbreaker, wherever you're going, I'm going your way. To off to see the world, there's such a lot of world to see. We're after the same rainbow's end, waiting round the bend, my huckleberry friend, Moon River, and me. See the world, There's such a lot of world